So you're pushing on the 14th.
I mean, you know.
My wife,
yeah.
We're not working straight.
Okay. So has OMA given
well,
you...
Well, that's a personal decision.
I'm going to call the House Committee on Health Care to order.
Whoops.
Okay.
For this.
You want to gavel again? We have a lot of noise.
I don't need to gavel again. I'm calling the House Committee on Health Care to order for this March 27th. I'm going to announce we are carrying over the work session on House Bill 2114 and House Bill 2388 to Wednesday. We don't have paperwork on those.
That's correct.
I'm still talking about some amendments, so that will be on Wednesday if we get the paperwork. We have an unfinished public hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3276. And I think we have two folks who were signed up or surrogates for those two to come and enlighten us.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, 3276, which was carried over from Friday, required the health benefit plan coverage of the health services to reimburse the cost of the necessary antitoxins, serums, vaccines, immunization agents, antibiotics, antidote, or any other necessary items in the event of a public health director determines that there exists a disease outbreak. We do have four people that were not able to testify on Friday. Mr. Chair, are you ready to bring them forward?
Go ahead, bring them up.
Thanks. Morgan Cowling, Charlie Vaughn, Fallon. That's an L. I apologize, sir. Colette Young. And then on deck will be Rachel Wiggins.
Go for it.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, vice chairs, and committee members. My name is Charlie Fountain. I'm a registered nurse and public health administrator for Benton County. Thank you for this opportunity to come back and complete testimony. I'm testifying on behalf of myself in Benton County and Dr. Bruce Thompson, our public health officer, who was here on Friday but couldn't return today. Benton County urges the committee support of House Bill 3276 because it will remove barriers to timely, equitable access to potentially life-saving medical treatments during infectious disease outbreaks, no matter where they occur in Oregon. At this moment, we are in the middle of Oregon's most recent declared outbreak of meningococcal disease. As you've heard, this outbreak began with two cases in November among OSU undergraduate students, and then late February, there was a third case, which raised it to the CDC threshold for a full-blown outbreak. In between the first two cases and the third case, we did considerable amount of joint planning for mass vaccination. And then when the third case happened at the end of February, we implemented those plans. And the mass vaccination clinics on the OSU campus is where we ran into our snag. Our target was to vaccinate 7,000 OSU students who were the most vulnerable. And as you heard on Friday, some insurance companies considered vaccine to be a medical benefit, so only nurses could deliver the vaccine. Other insurance plans considered the same vaccine to be only a pharmacy benefit, so only pharmacists could administer it. And in almost all plans, physicians could not administer the vaccine because the OSU field house where we were doing the mass vaccination clinic was not considered a medical facility. So we ran into a lot of real detailed complications. Several insurers, in addition, flat denied claims by OSU Student Health Service, citing a complete out-of-network exemption. Calls from the director of OSU Student Health Services and even a memo from the medical director of the Oregon State Medicaid program to CCO directors were not enough to clear these hurdles. So we started processing each student claim by claim, and we had eight volunteer insurance billers operating during this clinic. And even with that, It took anywhere from 45 minutes to 2 hours to clear a student through a clinic that the vaccination itself took about 15 minutes and then 10 or so minutes for them, 15 minutes for them to wait and make sure they were okay after the vaccine. So that was on the first day. And we only ended up, out of the 7,000 we targeted, we were only able to clear about 600 students through on the first day. On the second day, we increased the number of insurance billers from 8 to 12 with the hope of overcoming some of those hurdles and getting students through more quickly, and that helped somewhat. But what really surprised us was on the second day, we had a visit from the vaccine pharmaceutical distributor who saw what we were up against, and this person started making personal calls on their cell phone to insurance companies. And those calls, several companies lifted their restrictions as a result of those telephone calls from the vaccine representative. And as a result, we were able to double the number of the pace of students working through this. And we're really thankful to that pharmaceutical rep, but a little bit puzzled of why that person was able to clear hurdles that the medical director and the director of the Oregon Medicaid program could not clear.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Why didn't you just give the vaccine and straighten out the billing later?
We were trying to do that. There were just complications, and I wish the OSU people, the medical people who are here actually were doing that. But again, we had to determine which plan people had to route them to a pharmacist or route them to a nurse if they went to the wrong person. If the wrong person's initials were on that person's insurance claim, it would have been denied. So we had to determine what kind of a plan each person had to route them through the clinic. I wish we had been able to do exactly what you had said. That's how we plan mass vaccination.
Your student, well, their students and their health plan. It seems to me they should have just vaccinated those students.
You know, OSU was operating this. We wanted to get reimbursement for as much as we possibly could.
Yeah.
OSU had tried very hard to get funding just from either administration, from outside sources, to just cover the vaccine, Mr. Chair, and so they could run people through as fast as possible. They were unable to do that. It's a huge cost, and so they were trying to meet the billing requirements. And we honestly did not anticipate this kind of a bottleneck. We've been planning mass vaccination clinics and doing dry runs for years. We did this sort of thing with pandemic flu, with the H1N1 flu pandemic, and had not run into this kind of bottleneck
before. How much
before.
Was the price of that vaccine?
About $185 per dose.
That's the problem.
Yeah, it's an expensive vaccine. It takes two doses. For this particular vaccine, for the brand
the
you're using.
All right, I see why.
So we're well on our way to vaccinating our target group. This effort went more slowly. We're doing a second round of mass vaccinations in late April to get the second dose into students. And as you'll hear in other testimony, this is not just a problem with student health services. Local health departments around the state are running into the same problem. After the first two cases, when we were offering this vaccine, we sent out notice statewide to let medical practitioners and health departments know what was going on. And when students were home over winter break, a lot of them went to their local health department, went to their own provider to get vaccinated. And health departments were finding that they were out of network as well. And we're having to refer those students to local pharmacies. And of course, not everyone's willing to make two trips, and we lost some of them. So again, House Bill 3276 is an important public health step to assure coverage during these type of urgent situations, and we urge your support for this bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Morgan Cowling, and I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. So I have the honor and privilege to work with the 34 local health departments across the state. And that's 33 county-based health departments and one health district of three counties. I'm here today to share our support for House Bill 3276. Charlie did a great job explaining it, so I don't want to repeat anything he said, but one of the important aspects of this bill is it'll help assure the important preventative treatments will be widely, promptly available to exposed individuals during these infectious disease outbreaks. And really, when they are in an outbreak situation, time is of the essence. And so we want to make sure that this is a covered benefit. And OSU and U of O testified on Friday as to the challenges at a university student health center, but in the last 5 years we've had an additional outbreak in Crook County. So meningitis doesn't just happen on university campuses. So we want to make sure that wherever people are, or if they are traveling, that this when there's an outbreak, that this important vaccines are covered. Local health departments investigate and respond to communicable disease outbreaks on a regular basis. In 2015, 291 disease outbreaks were investigated. Urgent preventative treatment is not always needed in every outbreak, but when it is necessary, this bill would help ensure that everyone in Oregon who is exposed during that outbreak can receive timely preventative treatments no matter where their medical home is. In addition, we believe that this aligns with public health modernization and the efforts to update our public health system. Communicable disease investigation and management is one of those four core programs of a modernized public health system. We all know that the transmission of disease-causing bacteria and viruses is not constrained by county line, CCO boundaries, or insurance coverage areas. This bill will help Oregon's local public health departments to work together, providing more coordinated, accessible prevention services, even when an outbreak spread across jurisdictional boundaries. So we urge the committee's support of this, of House Bill 3276. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Colette Young. I'm the Center Administrator for the Center for Public Health Practice in the Public Health Division of Oregon Health Authority. I submitted testimony that largely reinforces what you've heard today and last week, and so I'm going to cut to the chase with a couple points that I think might be useful for you to know. So 2016, Oregon had 24 meningitis cases. 10 of them were meningitis B. And two of those were related to the outbreak we're talking about. In general, I think you mentioned it, we have about 300 outbreaks of reportable disease annually that we work with the local health departments closely to take care of and control. About 45 of those outbreaks a year are in schools and learning centers, and about 3 of those outbreaks are in universities and campuses. In the past 4 years, when I looked, we've seen on campuses chickenpox, we've seen noro, we've of course seen flu, meningitis, and mumps. And so that will give you a sense that we're not just talking about meningitis here, we're talking about a variety of diseases that we deal with all the time.
A few years ago, I think.
I'm sorry?
We had measles a few years ago.
And measles, yeah.
2003.
You remember well. So I think those are helpful for you in considering what the scope of the things that we're interested in with this bill. But I also want to reinforce that I think the task force would be very useful to all of us. I think we can leverage it to help us work on and exercise many of the roles, responsibilities, and actions we need to take in being effective in a university outbreak. And I encourage us to move forward with that piece. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one more witness. Is that one?
That is right, Mr. Chair. And that is Rachel Wiggins.
Let me see the bill.
Good
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and committee members. My name is Rachel Wiggins-Emery here on behalf of Cambia Health Solutions, testifying in reluctant opposition to Section 2 of House Bill 3276, the insurance mandate. This bill addresses a critical issue related to the administration of insurance coverage for immunizations when urgent mass immunizations are done in the university setting. This is not a question of whether health plans cover these vaccines. We do. The problem faced by university health centers and by health plans alike is an unfortunate intersection of federal health privacy and student privacy regulations, which in combination present regulatory barriers to putting university health centers under ordinary provider contracts, as we have with county health departments, to make it easy for us to reimburse university clinics with minimal administrative burden to our members, to universities, and to health plans. We believe that these issues are very resolvable without legislation if the key stakeholders involved, university clinics, public health, and health plans, could convene during the interim and craft a workable solution. We believe there may be several options, but this involves very technical areas of regulation and will require significant collaborative work by people with expertise in this space, and probably a great deal more time than session schedule allows for. This bill is drafted, and the amendment proposed might help student health centers, but at the expense of great administrative burden and potential conflict with rules that govern health plans, a Hobson's choice between following state or federal rules. It also only narrowly addresses vaccines, when we would like to explore making it easier for university clinics to get reimbursed for other health services provided to our member students. Our request is that, rather than attempt to quickly do a bill that could result in unintended consequences, that the committee charge the stakeholders with assistance from the Public Health Division of the Health Authority to work this issue through the interim and report back to you with a solution that works for all parties well in advance of the 2018 session. Our hope would be to report back to you that we found a non-legislative pathway, but if legislation is needed, we would hope to have a consensus bill.
Help us again with what are those unintended consequences you're worried about? Will you run that one by us again?
Yeah, absolutely. The concern is the overlay in HIPAA regulations and student privacy information, and that moving forward with this bill, there would be some administrative issues with working that out.
What sort of HIPAA violations are you worried about?
Unfortunately, I do not know, but I'm more than happy to get back to you, Chair.
Well, but you're testifying, you have concerns that there are going to be HIPAA violations, but you don't know what those HIPAA violations might be?
Specifically around the disclosure of information, but I don't.
You mean if a provider asks you for patient information, they would be violating HIPAA? You don't do that as a part of your routine insurance claims form?
Unfortunately, I apologize, Chair, I do not know.
The witness that was going to be able to answer the questions, Mr. Chair, she's not able to be here, so I don't think this person's.
I'm filling in for Elizabeth Friendly.
Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3276 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2931. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2931 comes to you at the request of Paul Terdahl and Representative Williamson. It clarifies the educational requirements for a behavioral analysis interventionist registration. And we have the first panel, Mr. Chair, is Paul Terdahl, Sarah Cooper, and Natalia Garrido.
Natalia Garrido.
Natalia, sorry.
Is there another panel coming?
If we have time, there are a couple other folks that may want to test it. No,
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Paul Terdahl. I'm a resident of Northwest Portland and the father of two children with autism. I did a lot of the work over the last few years developing the statutes related to insurance coverage and regulation of interventionists. This bill basically fixes a typo. It should be very simple. For brief background, behavior analysis interventionists are paraprofessionals. They do the hands-on applied behavior analysis therapy under the supervision of a licensed behavior analyst or other licensed healthcare professional with expertise in ABA, such as a psychologist. They are registered and regulated by the Health Licensing Office. The standard that we used in drafting the bill for requirements is based on what TRICARE was using for the same level of professional, as well as other national standards, such as from the BACB. And the education requirement was set at a pretty basic level. We said high school diploma or GED. The problem is that we said very specifically high school diploma or GED, and we have run into a number of cases where we have people with college degrees or even graduate degrees who, for whatever reason, did not actually have a high school diploma. They went ahead straight into college, and we can't get them registered. There's a very good written testimony from Footprints Behavioral Interventionists describing a situation they had a few months ago with a person with a bachelor's degree, national credentials, and so forth, and ended up disrupting her work for a couple of months to go back and redo a GED to comply with the paperwork. So what we're trying to do is basically fix that. Yes. So, and anything you wanted to add?
Just in the clinic that I work at, which is the Beaverton Card location. Oh, Natalia Garrido. I apologize. So just in the clinic that I work at, which is the Beaverton Card location, we've had three cases of therapists come through who were unable to get that credentialing through the state despite having either higher education or being otherwise qualified because of things like one of them went to a private high school that closed down and they no longer provided her with her GED. We had another therapist where her high school had burnt down. So it was an extended process in her to be able to get that despite having a bachelor's degree. We have another person that we were unable to credential despite having a bachelor's degree in behavior analysis as well.
I was trying to think about how to get my high school diploma. I'm not quite sure what I do.
My name is Sarah Cooper, and I'm the vice president of the Oregon Association for Behavior Analysis, and I'm here to show support for this bill.
Well, what specifically does the bill do?
Just very specifically, it changes the education requirement to say high school diploma. Currently, it says high school diploma or GED as the baseline requirement. We are changing that to high school diploma, comma, GED, comma, or a degree from a post-secondary institution. So that if you have a bachelor's degree, we don't ask you to track down your high school diploma. That's it.
Seems easy enough.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks.
We've got a work session on it. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2931. And do we have our... Stand down for a moment?
Well, Nathanson is here.
Okay. Good.
I'll go get...
We're going to open two. Why don't you open them and then you get them? I'm going to open two public hearings. One on House Bill House Bill 3085 and one on House Bill 3261. Ask Representative Nathanson to join us. Start the process and we'll get Senator Haywood to join us as well. Maybe you can tell us what the bill is about since I sent the administrator off to get our senator called.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson. I'm a state representative from House District 13. I'll start with a brief description then.
Thank you.
I'll take it from my notes. The 2015 Legislative Assembly enacted House Bill 3396, creating the Health Care Provider Incentive Fund to be administered by the Oregon Health Authority, and directed the Oregon Health Policy Board to evaluate the effectiveness of health care provider incentives and to produce recommendations for the legislature regarding continuing, restructuring, consolidating, or repealing current incentives, prioritizing incentive funds to qualified providers, and consideration of new financial incentive programs. We now have those recommendations, and this bill is designed to implement those recommendations and some other technical changes to improve the incentives and provide the Health Policy Board with the tools and authority to manage the programs in the incentive fund. According to the Healthcare Workforce Committee, states across the nation are struggling to deal with shortages in the number of healthcare providers and with significant maldistribution of current providers, leaving many communities underserved. Oregon is not immune from this. Oregon has provided a variety of financial incentives to help recruit and retain providers who work in rural and underserved communities, and those programs are successful at increasing the number of practitioners who serve in those areas. Practitioners and students have access to about a dozen state and federal programs, including tax credits, insurance subsidies, loan repayment, and loan forgiveness. Each of these was set up at different times with different criteria. We need to make sure we're making the most of the $30 million or so a biennium that we spend on incentives to recruit and retain healthcare professionals in rural and underserved areas. OHA contracted for a study to analyze the existing incentive programs. The Healthcare Workforce Committee also created a group that conducted listening sessions in rural communities across the state last year. They heard from providers, community leaders, clinic administrators, public health officials, and other stakeholders. The study found that all of Oregon's incentive programs are, quote, successful in increasing the number of providers in rural areas in Oregon, end quote. But they found that the programs could still be made more effective. The first recommendation was to enhance the type and amount of data available to policymakers and program administrators. According to the committee, increased data would better enable ongoing analysis and evaluation of the provider incentive programs. The committee's second recommendation was to expand program awareness and ease of use to improve utilization of the programs by the prospective providers. The committee also recommended restructuring some existing programs for greater effectiveness. Enhancing the flexibility of programs could maximize their impact. The Oregon Health Authority and the Healthcare Workforce Committee have started to implement recommendations within their authority, such as data sets and best practices for recruitment and retention. So what this bill does, first of all, there's a category of things I would call administrative changes. To improve Oregon's existing data collection and analysis, OHA, in collaboration with the Office of Rural Health, will collect information from participants in the programs in order to better evaluate program effectiveness, including more data on telemedicine services. The second administrative change, it directs development of a uniform application form for all provider incentive programs. Number three, and maintaining a website with consolidated important information about all of the programs. Four, eligibility requirements adopted for the program will have to meet certain conditions based on findings and recommendations from the study. For example, providers should be allowed to qualify for multiple incentives and must be allowed to qualify for an incentive for multi-year periods. Number five, the eligibility requirements must give preference to certain applicants, such as those willing to commit to extended periods of service in rural or underserved areas, or those who serve proportionately at least as many patients enrolled in the state medical assistance program and Medicare as the statewide ratio. Again, all of these are implementing recommendations that came from the Healthcare Workforce Committee through the Health Policy Board. Then there are some changes in incentives that this enacts. Again, most of them from recommendations from the committee's work or from testimony in the previous session. You'll recall that we have loan forgiveness, loan repayment, and other types of incentives. I'm going to mention only the ones that have changes recommended. The bill allows for the annual tax credit provisions for providers working at least 20 hours a week in a designated area. The amount of credit will be based on the location where the individual maintains an active practice. For 20 to 50 miles away from a major population center or qualified metropolitan statistical area, a $4,000 credit. Greater than 50 miles, $5,000. And for a county with a population density of six or fewer persons per square mile, a $7,000 credit. And the credit for 10 to 20 miles from an urban community was removed. It creates an additional tax credit of $1,000 if the individual is certified as a preceptor who supervises students, interns, or residents. This will create an opportunity for providers to take on apprentices without hurting their bottom line. Number three, scholarship funds would be available to all nonprofit Oregon schools with programs in the needed professions. The funds will be distributed proportionately based on the percentage of Oregon students attending those schools. Number four, the bill expands the kinds of incentives that may be provided, such as up to $25,000 for certain residency programs, and it adds locum tenens as an allowed incentive program. Not that money starts to be spent on it, it's just allowing flexibility to consider those kinds of programs for incentives. It's important to note that since the responsibility for viewing incentive programs and allocating money will be under the purview of the Health Policy Board, this bill is designed to give them the tools they need to make the best decisions possible. More data is one of those, and to give them the additional flexibility in types of incentives that may be provided so that they can be responsive to local situations and the market. There is also an amendment that's available to you. This bill covers a number of moving parts, lots of technical administrative changes and some policy changes. The one technical change is to change from the Healthcare Workforce Committee to the Health Policy Board, to which it reports. There will undoubtedly be several more changes that you would see reflected in another amendment. The use of these incentives to further encourage providers to practice in these underserved areas, combined with a more efficient and effective system, can help people in our state get the health care they need, regardless of where they live. The 2015 legislation was the first step toward more comprehensive programming. This bill is the next step. Quoting the Healthcare Workforce Committee report, quote, "Reworking our existing programs into a more flexible system of supports that can keep what works well, offer new approaches that should yield even more effective returns on our investments." Thank you.
Representative Senator Seiler, we've opened up both 3085 and 3345, so you can talk about either of them if you want.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton. And I'm pleased to be up here with Representative Nathanson to talk about two bills that are very important to both of us and we believe important to the entire state. I've worked with many of you for many years, including you, Mr. Chair, on health care provider incentives, and I think these bills represent the next step in evolution. There are really two separate issues, and I'm going to focus more. Representative Nathanson did a great job of describing 3261. I'm going to focus more on 3085. One of the problems that we have in this state is an inadequate pipeline of new providers. And when I say providers, I don't just mean physicians. I mean nurse practitioners and PAs and licensed professional counselors and social workers and psychologists and expanded permit dental hygienists. What Senator Bates and I came up with back in 2007, sort of critical access specialties, the kind of people you don't want to have to drive more than 50 miles to see. And those are the people that we know form the kinds of healthcare providers that we know form the backbone of true frontline provision of healthcare services, the things that focus on keeping people healthy and the things that help people stay that way, that do chronic disease management, and that help us achieve the triple aim of improving healthcare outcomes, improving healthcare delivery, and lowering costs for the state. There are reasons why our pipeline is inadequate, but one of the most important is that it's very hard and expensive to set up training programs. In particular, I'll give you a couple of examples. When it comes to graduate medical education, which is the kinds of training that physicians need to go through after medical school that lets them become certified in a specific specialty, much of that funding historically has come from the Medicare program. Now, the Medicare program was established primarily as a hospital benefit in the 1960s because that's really where the only care could be provided. We didn't have a lot of outpatient options then. And most residency programs, graduate medical education programs, took place in hospital settings, and they did not include a lot of outpatient training. Medicine has, not surprisingly, evolved a lot in the last 50 years, which is good, and much of what used to be done in inpatient settings is now done in outpatient settings, and we keep people out of the hospital as much as possible. So we need more training programs to be based in communities, to be more focused on outpatient care, and we need to not be funding graduate medical education specifically through Medicare, because they put caps on how many residents can be in any given hospital or even any given state. And what happens as a result of those caps is that places like St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, which could easily host a robust family medicine residency, and as you'll hear from Dr. Jet Malani, who I think Dr. Jet Malani's here. Yep. Well, Dr. Jet Malani, he's going to talk to you a little bit more about some options for psychiatry training in Central Oregon. We cannot get the appropriate funding from Medicare to start those programs because at some point in the remote past, St. Charles had a graduate medical education or residency program, ended up with one resident, and that hospital now has a cap of one. Starting a new residency program is expensive. It costs about $3 million to get it up and running. It takes about 3 or 4 years to do that, to get it certified, to get the faculty on board. And then while residency programs and other kinds of training programs can recoup some of their costs once they're up and running from the billing done by the healthcare providers in training, it does not cover the full costs because often faculty of whatever sort are in there working with the trainees, and you can't, of course, double bill for that service. So the goal of House Bill 3085 is to establish a fund called the Healthcare Workforce Training Fund that would be located in the Health Policy Board, as would Representative Nathanson's bill, to provide the opportunity to use funds to leverage against community efforts to help fund the startup or ongoing support of healthcare workforce training programs. And whether that's all of Eastern Oregon coming together, Eastern Oregon University with Blue Mountain Community College and Treasure Valley, and the cities of Pendleton, LeGrand, Baker, and Ontario, and Burns coming together in cooperation with Portland State to set up a social work program, which they're interested in doing, or starting family medicine residencies in Southern Oregon, or a nurse practitioner program extension in Central Oregon, or whatever is clearly in the best interest of the state to build the kind of robust frontline workforce that we need, communities could come together. They could establish a business plan for those programs. They could put skin in the game, i.e. time and money and resources. They could establish the right academic partners in collaboration with our university system, broadly construed, present those proposals to the Health Policy Board and apply for funding to support their proposal. This would not be a we're going to give you everything thing. This, as I said, the communities would have to have skin in the game. They'd have to be putting up money and time and effort, and that would be on an ongoing basis. But the Health Policy Board would establish criteria in cooperation with the health authority, with various medical professional organizations, other educational institutions, for what those business plans should look like. So it would be they would be held accountable, and we'd be sure that we were getting the most bang for the buck. The funding mechanism for this is unique to Oregon, but not unique to the United States. There are several states already that fund graduate medical education in particular through insurance assessments, and this is what this bill would do. I came up with the catchy sum of a penny per member per day, which turns out to be $3.65 per member per year. And that, while that doesn't sound like a lot, if you assess every member in a CCO in a traditional commercial insurer or through a third-party administrator, that turns out to be about 3 million people in this state, which comes to $22 million a biennium, which is a lot of money to support programs that we really need in the state to build our healthcare workforce. As in Representative Nathanson's bill, the monies could be used to help pay community preceptors because it takes time away from your practice to teach properly. There are a lot of different things that the funds could be used for. But it would be really targeted at putting the right kinds of training programs in the right locations across the state, incentivizing it. Representative Nathanson and I have been working very closely together and with you, Mr. Chair, to talk about both of these bills. And we believe that in order to provide funding for Representative Nathanson's bill, it might be useful, and we are in the process of drafting an amendment for 3085 that basically takes the bulk of her bill, adds it to my bill, and then turns it into 2 cents per member per day so that we can have a permanent fund and we're not coming back to the legislature every single year for the money to pay for these provider incentives that we all believe make a big difference in attracting and retaining a well-qualified healthcare workforce in this state. We can structure it so that it's always split 50-50, or I would propose that the Health Policy Board could make a decision on an annual basis with no less than one-third going to either incentives or workforce training programs. But that gives a little bit of flexibility depending on what the needs are in any given state. We believe the Health Policy Board is best positioned to make these decisions because of its broad representation and its independence. And obviously, they would take counsel from a wide range of sources, including the Office of Rural Health, which has historically administered some of these health care provider incentives. I don't want to take too much of the committee's time, and so I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take questions.
I assume 3085 will have to go to revenue and 3261 to Ways and Means if they remain separate.
I would believe so, yes, sir.
Where you both have some influence.
Revenue, not so much, but
not so much.
On the Ways and Means sides, we're good.
Vice Chair will take care of you.
Representative Bueller.
Are there Excellent. Questions of this expert panel? Okay, we've got lots of witnesses on both of them. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, Roach. And my apologies. My committee chair wants me back in the committee that I'm a member of.
I understand that.
I apologize for not staying. Thank you.
Okay, well, let's alternate between one bill and the other bill. And any of the witnesses on the two bills are free to talk about either of them.
Okay, so I'm calling from House Bill 3261 sign-up sheet, Scott Ekblad, Doug Barber, and Peter Engdahl?
Close enough.
I know.
I pronounce it similar.
Good. Feel free to slaughter my name, however.
Guys,
you feel.
We have tons of witnesses, so please be brief and parsimonious. Powerful with you.
Why don't you go first, Scott?
All right. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm happy to be here today and talk about House Bill 3261. The Office of Rural Health administers, I believe, all of the state-funded incentive programs, so I can talk a little bit about that history. This particular bill, 3261, does much more than what its summary would indicate. It represents the culmination of years' worth of work, as Representative Nathanson discussed just a bit ago, among many stakeholders, and literally holds the fate of our healthcare workforce, or at least the distribution of that workforce, in its text. I want to make sure we all understand that our healthcare workforce is not distributed in a way that allows equitable access to care for everyone in our state. Look at the provider-to-population ratio of pretty much any healthcare profession, and there are more per person in urban communities than in rural. There are more providers in affluent communities than in low-income communities, and there are more providers serving primarily white communities than serving communities of color. So we, in public policy and state-funded, we use public policy and state-funded financial incentives to persuade healthcare providers to locate in these underserved communities. The 2015 House Bill 3396 placed a sunset on all state-funded healthcare workforce incentive programs. Loan repayment, loan forgiveness, scholarships, tax credit, and malpractice subsidy. The intent was to force a serious evaluation of these programs and how public dollars are spent through them. The broad outcome of that evaluation was that all of our current programs are very effective. They should be made more available and funded at higher levels. The report also recommends that we encourage participation in more than one incentive program, as that results in exponential recruitment and retention effect. It's my understanding that the intent of House Bill 3261 is twofold. One, to make it easier for the legislature to make allocation decisions because all incentive funds will be considered as a whole. And two, it will allow for flexibility to move dollars from one program to another depending upon the need. I'm supportive of these goals, but with one exception. I do not think it's practical to include the tax credit program in that bucket. It's just too different. It's not a source of revenue. The application is very different. The intent is different. The qualifying criteria are different. It's not something that you can front load one year and take away the next. It's something that really has to be continual in order for it to serve its purpose. It's just too different, really, to be considered along with all the rest of these programs. So the Oregon Office of Rural Health, in closing, we support House Bill 3261. We're eager to work with legislators to continue to refine it. I must, however, voice one concern, that so far there's not a bill before the legislature that will fund any of these programs. Remember, they're all sunset, and so if we don't do something about it this session, they will all go away. We need to extend or remove the sunsets on these programs, but we also need to fund them. So with that, thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions. I hope there wasn't too much repetition.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association in support of House Bill 3261. That interim study that Representative Nathanson referenced, the Lewin Report, you probably have seen that. One of the key recommendations in that report talks about the loan repayment program and recommends that we that Oregon make more awards and larger awards in the loan repayment program. In the 2015-17 biennium, the loan repayment program received 150 applications, but there was only funding available to make 26 awards. We know the Oregon loan repayment program works. Some of the best data that we have for that program was about, we had a separate, slightly different loan repayment program that operated between 1994 and 2008. In OLIS, you will find a chart that looks like this that breaks down by individual how long they stayed in rural communities. So you can see there were 63 physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants who were awarded loan repayment during those years. Of those, 30 are still practicing in rural Oregon, and the 63 have put in a total of more than 600 years of medical care in rural Oregon. And many of that number keeps increasing every year. So clearly this is a good investment. The new Healthcare Workforce Incentive Fund will provide an umbrella for the loan repayment program as well as the scholarship programs like Scholars for Healthy Oregon, Loan Forgiveness, and the incentive programs like the Rural Malpractice Subsidy. Our hope is that that Workforce Incentive Fund will create both certainty for these important incentive programs, as well as some flexibility. We know, as I mentioned before, that the demand for programs like loan repayment far outstrips the funding. But this biennium, the malpractice subsidy program actually had more funding than it could use. Under the Workforce Incentive Fund, we would have the flexibility, the Health Policy Board and the Office of Rural Health would have the flexibility to move that funding into programs like loan repayment where it is more needed. As Scott mentioned, still to be developed for the Workforce Incentive Fund are the details about how much funding will be available for each of these programs and exactly how that mechanism will work. And we look forward to working with you as we develop those plans. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, you suggested that your office not administer the tax credit. And I think I understand your rationale for that. Is it just because everyone who applies for it gets it? And I think part of our desire to have somebody looking at that is that, are we spending that credit, you know, wisely? And we don't have a really good vehicle, except for maybe your office, to sort of analyze that. And I think that's why some of us wanted that to be housed there.
So Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, thanks for asking the question, because I apparently confused people unnecessarily. It's not that I don't want to administer the program. I don't think it should be considered in the same bill. I really think it needs to be considered separately. For example, this bill calls for a single application for all the programs, and I just don't think that would work for the tax credit. And, you know, for other administrative reasons, I just don't think it should be combined in with the rest of these programs. It's not something that you can budget out every year. Did that clarify?
Yep. But the tax credit is, as he said, anybody that qualifies for it gets it.
That's true.
So you don't, you really can't budget it in the same way. Okay.
That's true. Yep.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Hello. my name is Peter Engdahl, and I guess I'm kind of the current face of some of these programs, and I think we're in trouble if I'm the face for this. I grew up in Albany, and when I left Albany in the early 90s, I was nowhere on the medical school path. I was going to be the next Sam Malone from Cheers. Spent the next 10-plus years in Eugene following that dream, and someplace along the way, I realized that I kind of wanted to do more than just sling drinks. So I started volunteering for a little fire department in Dexter, Oregon, and I found out right away that in order to do anything really neat as a firefighter, you had to be an EMT. In order to do anything neat as an EMT, you had to be a paramedic. Taking advantage of community college programs, I was able to be trained as a paramedic, moved to Portland, and worked as a paramedic up in Portland in the early 2000s. With the support of my wife, I finally went back to school to get my bachelor's degree, and I like to say that things just kind of got out of control from there, and now I'm in med school, pursuing my dream to be a family physician, primary care doc in some smaller communities here in Oregon. When I was a firefighter in Dexter, when I was a paramedic even in Portland, saw the immense need for primary care, and it is no shock to anybody in front of me. I'm sure that we are lacking that primary care resource in a lot of our smaller communities in the state of Oregon. So I'm here to speak of a couple different programs that I've had the great fortune of taking advantage of while at school. The Oregon Rural Scholars Program, and of course the Primary Care Loan Forgiveness Program. Please forgive the indulgence. I will just tell you of my experiences. I know that earlier this year, or last year, excuse me, my wife and I, we had been funding my excursion through med school through student loans and doing fairly well. We suffered a family tragedy that is not unfamiliar to a number of thousands of people in Oregon and tens of thousands in this country. The insurance companies that we thought were there to protect us ended up finding a way not to pay for some needs for my wife, and basically kind of zapped all the money that I would have to continue med school. Thankfully, a lifeline was there, the Primary Care Loan Forgiveness Program, and I'm very, very happy to say that I was accepted earlier this year, and I will be able to continue my schooling, and I'm proud to say that part of my agreement to take this program is also to return after residency to a facility in rural Oregon and begin my career. The Oregon Rural Scholars Program is a very exciting program available to all med students and expanding to PA and nursing students around Oregon that gives us the opportunity to work in a number of locations throughout the state for an extended period of time. Mine was 12 weeks, and I got to be in Enterprise, Oregon, and that was truly magical. While there, I was still dealing with some of the my feelings about being in school after suffering a tragedy. I honestly can tell you that I was questioning my my resolve at that point, but it was this program that got me to see what being a primary doc in a community will be. Beyond the books, beyond merely just the studying, I got to live and learn what it's like to be in this wonderful small community. I got to feel what it will be like to be, to be in this community. Part of the programs that we have, I just want to share this real quick, is a community service project, which a number of us were able to help our clinics. One even developed an avalanche awareness program that's being taught in Eastern Oregon right now. Another one of my students developed a breast cancer screening plan, and then there's a scribe program now being developed to encourage young kids into medicine, all from Oregon Rural Scholars. Sorry for taking up so much of your time.
Appreciate
any questions?
Appreciate your story.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could you call the next panel, please? See, we have so many people who are interested in helping us today.
I'm going into the House Bill 3085 witness registration. Alex Burdick, Chip Taylor, Catherine Cushing.
Please be as brief as you can be.
Who do you want to go?
Before the bill is over.
Okay. Question. Chairman and panel, thank you for having me here. My name is Dr. Alexandra Verdick, and I am the Associate Residency Director of Family Medicine at OHSU, and I can speak to graduate medical education, specifically in family medicine. The Graham Center put out a study on the Oregon healthcare workforce saying that we need a 38% increase in our number of physicians, which includes, so that totals 1,174 new physicians, which would provide us with an adequate workforce in all of medicine. And this is needed across the entire state, rural areas, semi-rural areas, and urban areas. And this is thought to be due to, especially in the more urban areas, a population influx, but in all areas, an aging population and retiring physicians. In rural areas, all of our providers face difficulty recruiting physicians to stay there. You know, one of the main ways to get someone to come to a rural area is if they grew up in the area, and that certainly for our physicians and medical students is a very underrepresented part of our medical school class. They're needing to hire locums to just even staff their practices, which obviously is costly, and these are not people that tend to stay in the community. In our one of our residencies in Klamath Falls, you know, the majority of the people practicing in the community or on the faculty are actually people who went through the residency and stayed. So they have actually got people to stay in that community by training them in that community. Just to tell you a little about Oregon, I mean, what we know about residents is residents tend to stay in the area where they did their residency. Over 50% of people will stay within 100 miles of where they actually did their residency. In family medicine, Oregon, we have 34 residency slots, most of them in the cities, you know, six in Klamath Falls, which is we're considered a rural residency, and two in Hood River. At OHSU, in our family medicine program, we got 600 applications for 12 spots. Oh, so, and this happens across all of the residencies. There's many people that want to at least consider coming here, but we do not have the spots to actually have them train here. In OHSU, in the last class that just graduated, 20 people went into family medicine. Eight of them are staying in Oregon. So of those eight, maybe they'll stay in practice here. But of those 12 that have left Oregon to train somewhere else, maybe we'll get a few back. And that might be because they're actually from here, if they're from here. The Comp Northwest in Lebanon does a much better job. They put about 30 to 40 people in family medicine a year. Two of them in the last class I could see are staying in Oregon for training slots. And that is because there really aren't the slots there. So my testimony is really in support of increasing not just family medicine, but other training spots. I think Dr. Steiner spoke very eloquently about the difficulties, but there are ways to get more training spots, and I think it's something we should work on, and this fund would help with that.
Thank you.
Why don't you go next?
Okay, I will.
So, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you so much for having me. My name is Catherine Cushing, and I am speaking in support of House Bill 3085 on behalf of the Oregon Graduate Medical Education Consortium. A mouthful, I know, and I'm happy to answer questions about that later if you're interested. As members of the committee know, we're suffering a severe physician shortage. So, Doctor just mentioned Robert Graham Center predicts we need, you know, over 1,000 new physicians just to maintain the status quo by 3030. There's another report that was done by the Oregon Health Authority that reported between 2013 and 2020, there will be a 16% growth in demand for physicians, nurse practitioners, and physicians assistants over the 2013 demand. So again, that's, you know, to even come up to the status quo, we're already behind. The Oregon GME Consortium is addressing the shortage of primary care physicians in our state by providing assistance and resources to hospital and clinics to establish primary care residencies outside the Portland metro area. As was mentioned, studies show physicians tend to stay where they do their residencies. Some studies show up to 70% will stay near where they did those residency programs. So they're very, very important. Primary care residency programs in rural locations are absolutely the best way we know how to get physicians to a rural location and keep them there. Developing residency programs, however, is expensive and requires a great deal of capacity and commitment from hospitals, clinics, physicians willing to train, and from the residents themselves. Hospitals in the consortium are already using consortium grant money and their own resources to begin developing new programs, and thank you very much to the legislature for providing some of that grant money to the Oregon GME Consortium. However, ongoing funding is a problem, and while hospitals are willing to shoulder their share of the burden, they don't want to do it all alone. They already put in a lot of not just capacity, but actual dollars on the table to both try to recruit physicians and, as we're trying to develop new residency programs, to do that. House Bill 3085 would assist hospitals and other training institutions in making sure Oregonians are able to receive timely and appropriate care when and where they need it. It would spread the burden among a larger group of stakeholders and make it more likely that health care providers are practicing in the places where they're most sorely needed. I encourage the committee to vote yes on House Bill 3085. Thank you.
I guess I got to bring up the back of this. My name is Dr. Chip Taylor. I'm a family physician by training. I'm a retired Navy captain. When I got out of the Navy, I joined the faculty at OHSU. I practiced there for about 4 years and left for a little over 4 years ago to move to Roseburg, Oregon, where I was the chief of staff at the VA for a short period of time before leaving to private practice. I currently practice in a federally qualified health center. I am one of those family doctors at the tip of the spear. I have 4 points to make to you, and I guess I'm sort of the color person like the student here. I am the residency director for the newly formed Roseburg Family Medicine Residency, which was a recipient of the funding, one of the first recipients from the OGMEC. And so I have 4 points to make. And I think I'm just reiterating what other folks had to say. There is a pressing need for primary care in rural areas and replacement. We are a net exporter of doctors in the state of Oregon, and we shouldn't be. Training family physicians in rural areas is the best way that I know of to keep them where they are going to practice. And if you don't think that ongoing funding is the barrier to standing up these programs, then you should have a few moments with Catherine to talk about the stories that we heard every time we went around with the OGMEC to why we don't have a residency in Medford or in, you know, Eugene or in Roseburg. I mean, these are places where we ought to have residencies, and we just don't. So the need in Roseburg, to put a face on this, a 2015 need survey from our hospital said we were 18 family docs short. That was before last summer when we had 5 of our primary care docs retire or go to become hospitalists. I see in my practice at the FQHC 6 new patients a day, every day. Second, we are a net exporter. With the two medical schools, we are a net exporter. The model that we have for success of standing up a new program is in Corvallis. Samaritan Hospital, I just met with them last week. If I've got these numbers right, 50% of their new graduates practice within 50 miles of their hospital, and 75% are staying in the state of Oregon. If we bring family physician residents to a community, they will be in our community for 3 years. Their family will get to be part of the community. Their kids will be embedded in the schools. Their spouses will find jobs. It will keep them embedded in the community. What I like to say about our current programs, when I recruit, I fear the touch and go, where someone comes to the community, they discover that the Macy's is closed, and they're out the door. It really is a challenge. There's significant benefit to the community, and let me wrap up by talking about the ongoing funding. Roseburg is really the example. You may have heard about this before. We are a sole rural hospital. We get Medicare funding that is in our base. We would have to give up that funding if we took on residents and got what is called indirect funding, which forms the bulk of the money that Medicare gives to a facility to say, here, train these people, and this will help to cover all of the costs of that. So hospital in rural America can't give up money that's already in its base to take on new money. But we think it's so important that we begin the residency program in order to recruit and fill those now, 23 spots that we've got vacant today for primary care docs, that we've gone ahead and taken the first step of putting skin in the game to get a residency going. So I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Ms. Kenny-Guyron, you have?
Yeah, thank you. Obviously, the program is very, very valuable, so thank you for focusing on this. I'm just curious about the piece, and Scott and Doug brought it up on a previous panel about dedicated funding for this, and the bill calls for 1 cent per day per person from insurers. I don't know how much that would bring. I'm curious about how what's the estimate on that?
$22 million
it was? And how much that compares to what you had in the past, the program that got phased out in order to be replaced by something. And if you have any ideas of other ways to have a dedicated source, because I understand the need for the long term. If you're this, the point is that it's not a one-time funding. You've got to support someone over several years, so you don't want to be asking the general fund every 2 years. Do you have other sources? I'm thinking obviously about OHSU. I know there's been stuff in the news about executive compensation. The state already puts in somebody.
They also recommended putting the two programs together and putting 2 cents in, which would be about 45 million.
So I just wonder, you know, we already put some public investment into OHSU. This is an investment that OHSU, having trained people in medical school, wants to make sure that that investment is protected. And I'm just wondering, is there, you know, what are the other sources beside insurers, a fee on insurers? What are some of the thinking behind whether OHSU can help? I'm just curious.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny-Guyron, excellent question. Let me just start by saying GME funding is the most complicated thing I have ever tried to learn in my entire professional life. Honestly, it is arcane, it is Byzantine, it is unbelievable, really, if you get into it. So some ongoing funding is provided by the federal government. That's what Chip was alluding to. Some of our hospitals in Oregon, including OHSU right now, receive some ongoing funding from CMS. Roseburg's hospital will not receive very much. As Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, St. Charles in Bend will receive almost no federal funding because of, those rules. Yeah. There has never been ongoing state funding for GME outside of a small portion that's tied to Medicaid. So there is some money that goes without regard to specialty or anything like that from Medicaid to hospitals or organizations that are hosting residents. OHSU right now definitely hosts the most residents. They train lots and lots of people. They have a fantastically broad mission. They receive the bulk of that funding just because they have the most residents. But other than that, there really is no dedicated state funding to GME. The grant that the Oregon GME Consortium received is pretty much startup funding. So we received a $1.5 million grant that we hope is going to to jumpstart several programs, just like it has begun to jumpstart the program in Roseburg. Other sources of funding, right now, for a hospital to stand up a residency program, they're going to have to shoulder a lot of that. Of that burden, and they know that. The hospitals that participate in our consortium right now realize and are very willing to put in their fair share.
Can you cut your answer short?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've got about 30 people
shorter.
To get tested in the next 30 minutes.
Again, it's a complicated subject. But I think the short answer is there isn't much ongoing funding right now. This bill would provide a portion, not all of it, and we hope that communities, grant funding, and hospitals will provide the rest.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You call the next panel, please.
This will finish this page.
Okay.
Ann Nessie,
mm-hmm.
Mark Overbeck, and David Pollock. And David Pollock has signed up on both bills, as Ann has also, so please speak to
both bills.
At the same
time. Give them about a minute each. That would be...
I can talk quickly, I think. I'm new here. My name is Ann Nessie, and I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon, but I also lived in rural Oregon. My husband was a family physician there for 17 years. And I can tell you, and my daughter was a nurse practitioner in the Dalles up until recently. Yeah, I did. Ann Nessie.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I have intimate experience with this, and even though what we tend to see is that practitioners can tend to stay there, many do not stay for all different reasons. If their spouse doesn't find employment that they really like, so they may get trained there, but it doesn't guarantee anything. And so you're investing a lot of money not really knowing. And I particularly, when I looked over 3085, we're talking 20 to 30 million, is that what they said? I would like to see a little bit better evaluation from a tax point on 3261. I know they talked about retention, but as I said, retention isn't always related to the fact that you were trained there. It involves a whole different set of things. You might be from another state, and my husband was, and he came here to Oregon to practice. So just having a nurse practitioner or a resident, they may be trained in Portland, but if they really like hunting and fishing or whatever that community offers, it might be more of an advertising thing, getting the right people to match the thing rather than a money thing. But you do need loan repayment. And my daughter at least told me that the federal programs were pretty generous. They were so generous that she paid off her loans in 4 years. So for a nurse practitioner. So it's not all that hard to do. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I saw you 2 weeks ago. My name is David Pollock, and I'm professor for public policy at OHSU. I'm in both the departments of psychiatry and family medicine, both of which have been mentioned today, and also in public health and preventive medicine. And I teach in our division of management, which has our health management MBA program. I'm also on two of the state's committees, the subcommittee that's the values-based benefits subcommittee of the Health Evidence Review Commission, or HERC, and the Healthcare Workforce Committee that's already been mentioned several times very graciously by Representative Nathanson and others. I chair that committee, and my fairly close friend and staff person, Mark Overbeck, is here, and a former staff person of our committee was Catherine Cushion, who just spoke, who represents and works as the director of the GME Consortium, which is one of the offspring of our committee. I won't repeat a lot of the things I said last time about what the committee has done. It's already been cited, the study that we've done that was a product of House Bill 3396 last session, that the report that we did about the incentive programs, others have mentioned, but I can tell you that we, as a committee, are very hopeful that the recommendations that we made will be actualized. What I'd like to say is more specific to both bills, but I'll read some of what I'm going to say about, first about House Bill 3085. The bill, as Senator Steiner Hayward said, would create a healthcare professional training fund that would be derived from funds, not from taxes, but from the health insurers, the health payers, including PBM and OF and the CCOs and the commercial insurance organizations. This mechanism would provide a robust, feasible, and sustainable source of funding for strategically expanding and improving the healthcare workforce. The source of funding makes sense in that the health payers are dependent upon a well-trained, system-ready workforce. So this should be seen as a worthy investment in sustaining our efforts to assure a quality workforce for the state's future. The fund would be available for a variety of uses that would be consistent with a number of the workforce committees and, by extension, the Health Policy Board's goals. These include starting new health care professional training programs, such as family medicine and general psychiatry and general internal medicine. These are areas that our committee a number of years ago had recommended to the Health Policy Board and, by extension, to the legislature, needed to be added to the postgraduate training in the state. Compensation for healthcare professional trainees, expansion of racial and ethnic diversity in the healthcare workforce, expansion of healthcare workforce in underserved areas, supplementing GME funding for hospitals, and some incentives for faculty and preceptors. Our committee absolutely agrees that adding graduate medical education training slots targeted to critical practice areas, including family medicine and psychiatry, is an important strategy to build the healthcare workforce that we need in Oregon. As you've already heard, we have fewer people than we need, and we're not adding enough, and we're having a higher rate of people retiring earlier. We're excited to hear about this new first residency program being initiated at Mercy in Roseburg, as you just heard about. Providing funds to hospitals will contribute to more GME in Oregon, and we're happy to support this concept. At our last committee meeting, we heard a report from Catherine of the GME Consortium, and we're pleased with the progress that's being made. The Health Policy Board provided the committee with our new charter just a few weeks ago. Over the next 2 years, we've been charged to work with educational institutions and leaders in various health professions to identify and develop the essential competencies.
Can you wrap it up?
I will. Then, among the priorities that we think are important is increasing the attention to training health program administrators and managers to be more aligned with the health reforms that the state has been articulating and implementing. The inclusion of improvement science in the curricula of all the training programs in the state. This new textbook, Health System Science, is an example of the kind of training we're trying to get people to understand about the context in which healthcare is provided and how we can do healthcare improvement and how students need to understand about that and the rest of the system. The fact that climate science and its health, mental health, and public health impacts are, in effect, the ultimate social determinant of health now needs to be more of a focus of our training programs. And finally, I'll say that if we get to the point of explicitly talking about graduate training programs, residencies for psychiatry, we should have language in those that say there should be a minimum amount of the time that those residents would spend in integrated care settings, because that's a big direction that psychiatry is going, especially something that the state needs in relation to our primary care medical home programs. And I can just endorse what others have said about House Bill 3261, that I think it would also, combined with 3085, as the senator and the representative have suggested they would do, I think be a good shot in the arm for the state in terms of the work we're doing at the Workforce Committee. And I'll pass it on to Mark.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake and members. My name is Mark Overbeck. I'm the director of the Primary Care Office in the Health Policy and Analytics Division of the Oregon Health Authority. You have a copy of my written testimony, so in the interest of time, I'll just hit a couple of the high points before seeing if there are any questions that you may have. The effort to master the problem of the supply and distribution of our healthcare workforce has been going on for some time. In addition to what Representative Nathanson and Senator Steiner Hayward spoke to, back in 2009, when you first put together the Oregon Health Policy Board and the Workforce Committee, you charged the committee with helping Oregon chart the course for a robust healthcare workforce for the future. We've heard about many of those pieces. We also have the Healthcare Workforce Reporting Program, which was set up in 2009 to give us a better understanding of where are people, what are they practicing, and how many do we need, and who are they serving. Reforming Oregon's programs, or provider incentive programs, for maximum effectiveness is a process that's been taking place over time, and it's on the right track. House Bill 3261 is intended to help keep Oregon moving forward. And on behalf of the Health Authority, I'd like to offer just a few reflections and recommendations on the bill as introduced. Given that it's the sponsor's intention to bring all the programs together, recommend having the primary care loan forgiveness program expressly named in Section 1 of the bill. Developing the common application, which Representative Nathanson spoke to, is something that the Health Authority can accommodate, and we're working with Legislative Fiscal Representative Nathanson to determine how can we do that with a reasonable cost. Regarding the oversight of the Health Care Provider Incentive Fund, we'd like to say that OHA is absolutely prepared for the role. We believe that our work with our colleagues in the Oregon Office of Rural Health since 2014 on the Medicaid Primary Care Loan Repayment Program has been a demonstration of what a strong partnership can look like between our two entities. Finally, a couple of other policy pieces. The addition of Medicare-covered individuals being added to the program is an interesting policy perspective. It's certainly up to the legislature to say who are the target audience of patients to be recipients and recipients of these incentives. You may wish to consider, if you go with Medicare, also adding low-income uninsured. And then with regard to the tax credits, two things stand out. One is in the listening sessions held last year, we heard from many people across the state about the need for additional preceptors. You've heard that today. Secondly, the study of the incentive programs that was referenced from the Lewin Group found little evidence of an impact on the attraction of providers to an area from the tax credit, but it did identify a positive impact on the retention of those providers over time. The legislature may wish to consider some time limitations to how long the credit will be able to be taken advantage of by.
Get you to wrap it up, please.
And with that, I'll stop speaking and invite any questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel. We're just pressed for time. We have seven more on one of these bills, and we have another bill here. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3261. I'm going to open up another bill. I'll try not to confuse the issue because I want to hear testimony on both of them. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3345. We still have 3085 open. Madam Administrator, what do we have in this bill, please?
House Bill 3345 is before the committee today at the request of Representative Helm. It expands the definition of public place to include common areas of commercial residential buildings and residential buildings with two or more rental units. It increases the distance from the current 10 feet to 25 feet for parts of public places and places of employment in which a person may not smoke, aerosolize, or vaporize. And we have that with this registration in front of us, too.
Would you call the first panel, please?
We're going to call Karen Gerard, Christopher Friend, and Christina. Will Clemmer?
Do you want me to time them, Mr. Chair? Like
we no, that's the first panel.
I'm sorry. Right, Bodimer? What's that?
Yeah, I could.
Okay.
Bodimer?
Just wanting to make
that's
sure
a D?
I'm being called.
Yes.
Right.
Sorry.
They're all in favor.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Please start.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Karen Gerard, the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Section Manager at the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to present information about expanding the Indoor Clean Air Act. Oregon's Indoor Clean Air Act protects nearly every Oregonian from the health risks of secondhand smoke. When it first passed in 2001, the Indoor Clean Air Act was a major public health accomplishment for Oregon, offering a real opportunity to reduce health care costs and deaths from tobacco-related diseases like cancer, heart disease, and stroke. And by prohibiting smoking in the workplace and public places within 10 feet of all entrances, the Indoor Clean Air Act offers a critical public health protection that will result in reduced deaths later. The Indoor Clean Air Act works. Since the law went into effect, adults exposed to secondhand smoke at work have decreased by 45%. In 2015, the Indoor Clean Air Act was expanded by the legislature to include marijuana and inhalant delivery systems, and these expansions strengthened Oregon's law and positioned Oregon as a national leader in secondhand smoke protection. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention identifies the establishment and expansion of smoke-free policies as an evidence-based practice for reducing the prevalence of tobacco use and along with the exposure to secondhand smoke. The U.S. Surgeon General states there is no safe level of exposure to secondhand smoke. House Bill 3345 would potentially reduce exposure to secondhand smoke, tobacco use, and the health and economic burdens of tobacco products placed on Oregonians by expanding the reach of the Indoor Clean Air Act to include an additional 15 feet of space around all building entrances. This increase in distance would align us with our neighbor to the north, Washington State, and enhance protections from the harm of secondhand smoke for employees and the public. Most Oregonians recognize the benefits of the Indoor Clean Air Act, with over 60% of Oregonians showing support for increasing the distance beyond 10 feet. Expansion of the Indoor Clean Air Act could reduce the number of children, Oregon children and young adults that become addicted to tobacco, help current tobacco users quit, and reduce health care costs for the state of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Christopher Friend. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. We're the advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society, and our members are dedicated to ending cancer as a major health illness by advancing evidence-based policies. It's a privilege to address the committee today in support of House Bill 3345. I'd like to thank Representative Helm for introducing the bill. ACSCAN supports the law, which prevents and reduces exposure to secondhand smoke. Smoke knows no boundaries, which is why ACSCAN supports expanding the buffer zone to 25 feet. A recent study conducted by Stanford University concludes that the further you are away from a smoker, the air quality improves. Additionally, we support House Bill 3345 because it expands the definitions of to common areas. ACSCAN supports the expansion because it ensures that renters will not be pestered by persistent secondhand smoke from their neighbors nearby. As a renter myself, I know exactly how pervasive the smell of secondhand smoke can be. One of my neighbors is a tobacco smoker, and expanding the range to 25 feet is something I support personally. Finally, ACSCAN is in support of House Bill 3345, I would like to raise that we would cautiously do so because we know that there are other proposals in the legislature to weaken the Clean Indoor Air Act. For example, 2736, which would allow consumption of alcohol in smoking lounges, or a proposal on the House side, which would allow the flavoring, tasting of e-cigarettes in public places as well as a variety of proposals that allow public use of marijuana.
Let's stick to this bill.
You bet. I personally support this bill. I encourage you to as well, and I'm thankful that it also includes e-cigarettes. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina Bodemer, and I'm the Government Relations Director for Oregon for the American Heart Association, here today in support of HB 3345. Research shows that smoking bans lead to marked reductions in cardiovascular incidents. Secondhand smoke causes heart disease, cancer, lung disease, and other illnesses to both children and adults who don't smoke. Studies suggest that even brief exposure to secondhand smoke can cause damage. In fact, evidence shows immediate adverse effects on heart function, blood platelets, inflammation, and the vascular system with even minor exposure. And long-term risk for non-smokers who are exposed to secondhand smoke have an increased
risk of developing heart disease by 25% to 30%, and an increased risk for stroke of 20% to 30%. There's even preliminary research that suggests an association between dementia syndromes in adults and exposure to secondhand smoke. Model legislation now recommends a minimum of 15 feet with a suggestion of 25 feet from distances from exits, entrances, windows, and vents of public places and places of employment where smoking, aerosoling, and vaporizing are prohibited. Oregon has already provided its citizens with protections against secondhand smoke, and the American Heart Association supports any efforts to continue and expand these protections. Thanks. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Pam. Thank you. I'm going to call a panel of a couple of folks in opposition to the bill.
Joe Gilpatrick and Jason Weber.
Chair Greenlick, committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Joseph Gilpatrick. I'm a vape shop owner in the town of Lebanon. I just wanted to touch base on what has happened since the Clean Air Act, where we cannot longer vape in our vapor shops. As you know, they are minor prohibited vapor shops, where we used to use our vaporizers to sample products for, you know, to find out which nicotine strength or which flavoring in which you would try, you know, to help yourself get off of traditional tobacco smoke with a vaporizer. Now at this point, since the Clean Air Act has been in effect, our customers go outside to try their products to make sure their products are working properly. We can test their new devices, make sure that there's no issues with it, so they're comfortable with it. And at this point now, we do go outside, but it's 15 feet from our doorway. Our business has been hurt very badly from the fact that now we have to staff three people instead of one. We have to go outside to talk with our customers. And now we're a public display for now any child or person out in front of our shops, where previously we were in an adult-only atmosphere, you know, with vapor products. And as it stands today with the Clean Air Act, you can still smoke cigars and cigarettes in over 30 locations for tobacco because they have an exemption the way that the Clean Air Act is written. So what I am proposing today is I am against the bill the way that it's written, but I would be in support with the -1 amendment, which would keep it, you know, out of the eyes of children and minors and put it back inside of a vape shop in an adult-only atmosphere. And that's where I stand on that today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Weber. I own Vape Crusaders LLC out of Roseburg. And my testimony is in regards to the -1 amendment, sampling in vape shops. A study from the Spanish Council of Scientific Research, which was also shown by the CDC, shows that secondhand vapor.
We don't have a -1 amendment, so I assume there's one coming, is that right?
There is.
Okay. Yeah.
I thought it was
Matt Minahan, the lobbyist for Select Vapors, had put it in. It is there. So.
Well, he hasn't given it to us as a committee member because we don't have it.
Oh, okay.
But if it's coming, we'll make it available.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry. A study from the Spanish Council of Scientific Research, which was also shown by the CDC, shows secondhand vapor is non-toxic. The study showed that the measure of volatile compounds were the same or sometimes even less than regular exhaled breath, and that's an indoor study. And that's because one of the main ingredients in the e-liquid that we manufacture is propylene glycol, which is known to help clear out smokers' lungs and help asthmatics not need their inhalers. There was also a study that even traces back as far as 1942 showing that propylene glycol can help fight off viruses such as the flu. That study was by Dr. Oswald.
Antifreeze.
Hope. I'm sorry?
It's also good for antifreeze.
It's also in non-toxic antifreeze. All this to say that vaping shouldn't even be included in the Clean Air Act because it's not harming anyone. We need our sampling back. What I do is I help folks quit by switching to a 95% safer option, which is vaping. To do that, I need to be able to help them find two things. One is the right setup, and the second is to find the right flavor. If I can't have them sample flavors, then they could end up leaving my vape shop with something they dislike, which is not going to help them quit smoking, and most likely that will frustrate them and not even bring them back to my shop. You know, we can do the samples without nicotine. We don't allow minors in our store, so I just don't understand why that would be a problem for anyone. Thank you.
Thank you guys very much. We're going to step back now for a panel from
3085.
Okay. Jim Schlenker? Schlenker? Dr. Jet Mollett?
Jet Malani.
Jet Malani. And Christopher Swide.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. My name is Jim Schlenker. It's tough even for me to say at times. And I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Good Shepherd Healthcare System in Hermiston, Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3085. As you know, there's a shortage of healthcare professionals in rural Oregon, and hospitals like mine are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to recruit and retain physicians and other professionals with very little success. Oregonians who live in Hermiston and the surrounding area have had a hard time receiving health care. There simply aren't enough doctors to go around. And the outlook, based upon current physician shortages and future projections, which you've heard earlier today, is abysmal. Because of the struggle to recruit physicians, hospitals in my region of northeastern Oregon are looking for innovative ways to cope with the shortage. Good Shepherd is a member of the Oregon Graduate Medical Education Consortium that Catherine Cushing spoke of earlier, which is trying to help hospitals create new residency programs in more rural parts of the state. Doctors are more likely to set up practice in rural communities if they have spent part or all of their residency there, and you've heard some of that testimony earlier today as well. Good Shepherd Hospital is more than willing to help train doctors and other professionals. We are investing money right now in the consortium and happy to invest further in the training that our friends, neighbors, and family members can have adequate health care in the communities they live. However, we cannot do this alone. Healthcare professional training, especially physician residency training, is expensive and requires a huge commitment on the part of the hospital, physicians already practicing in the community, and the community itself. This is a burden that needs to be more widely shared. House Bill 3085 helps to spread out the cost of healthcare professional training among more stakeholders. This bill could help be the difference between people in the communities like Hermiston, Pendleton, and LeGrand being able to receive the care of a doctor, physician, nurse, or physician assistant in their community when they need it, as opposed to being forced to wait until they need much more expensive intensive specialty care in a much larger tertiary facility, possibly in Portland. Thank you very much for taking the time today to hear my perspective on this very important issue, and if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you for coming all the way over from Hermiston. That's a long drive. We appreciate it.
How are you? Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlich and the members of the committee. My name is Christopher Swide. I'm a professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at OHSU. I'm the anesthesiology program director, and I also serve as the assistant dean of graduate medical education at OHSU, where we oversee all of our 80 programs in graduate medical education. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3085, which establishes the Healthcare Professional Training Fund. First, we are very supportive of increased funding for healthcare professional training in Oregon. I want to be clear, I do understand that graduate medical education is not the only need to be addressed in this, and we do support this bill's broad reach to train a variety of healthcare providers. My area of expertise is graduate medical education. So I'd like to describe how this bill can immediately support growing GME in Oregon to the benefit of the health needs of Oregonians. OHSU, as was mentioned earlier, is the largest provider of clinical training of physicians with graduate medical education in the state. We have over 841 residents and fellows. The cap was mentioned, and I'll mention that again in my testimony here. Only 272 of those positions are with the cap. The cap was set in 1996, since all the growth of GME since that time has had to find other funding sources. Currently, OHSU Healthcare itself puts over $18 million a year into graduate medical education. Additional support comes from affiliation agreements with other health systems, as well as VA, the Veterans Administration, which is a strong partner at OHSU. There's broad-based agreement and that there's a critical need for additional GME spots within our state, especially in rural and underserved parts of Oregon. The challenge, which has been mentioned by many people here, is graduate medical education is very expensive, particularly to start. These are not apprenticeship programs. The ACGME, the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, is the sponsoring body. The DO programs in the state will be moving under ACGME over the next 3 years. And all of the ACGME has very rigid requirements of what it takes to build a graduate medical education. This involves the program director qualifications, the DIO, the designated institutional official, the person who oversees it, the faculty, assessment processes, et cetera, et cetera. These infrastructures costs can easily exceed $2 million over the first 2 years of a program, and this is before you'll start receiving any federal funds if your hospital is a new training hospital and eligible for a new cap. The programs in Oregon, and there's plenty in the state, that are new teaching hospitals, you can attract federal funding via Medicare. There is no cap when you start. But what's important is that once you bring the first resident on the ground, physically on the ground, and put them on your cost report, you have 5 years to plan out how much, because it'll cap at 5 years. It's very important strategically that you plan what you want that hospital to have for the future, because after 5 years, it's locked. And if you don't think strategically that we want this many doctors in this area, and you just start small and keep it small, you won't be able to expand using federal dollars. So having these types of funds can help with the beginning costs and also to help with the transition costs. It does take about 2 to 3 years to start receiving funds for the direct IME as well as per resident amount from CMS for a new training program. In the meantime, you still got to pay all those salaries of the learners on the ground. Certainly, we've talked about that here, is that GME is the predictor and the main predictor of where you do it is where you stay. So to train people within the state and particularly in our smaller communities will be a great step to build out additional physicians within our state. This funding in HAM OHSU is very excited to collaborate with hospitals and health systems in helping to build this. We have a lot of expertise to share. We're also a partner within GME Consortium. So I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for this testimony.
Thank you so much. Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Ajit Jamalani. I'm a child analysis psychiatrist and clinical professor of psychiatry at OHSU and head of the Division of Child Psychiatry. I am going to just focus on ways to improve access for mental health providers in our state, and I've submitted riveting written testimony that you can look at later. Provider shortages and access issues can be addressed in two different ways, I think. One is by increasing the supply of providers, and the other is improving the mental health capacity in the primary care medical home, or in other words, improving the primary care's ability to actually treat themselves, treat mental health conditions themselves. We've attempted at OHSU to develop a adult psychiatry program, for instance, in Central Oregon. And the proposal that had been made was to have 3 adult psychiatry slots, and just to give you an example of what one might be able to do, and 1 child psychiatry slot. When you have an adult psychiatry program, it's a 4-year program. So by the end of 4 years, you would have 12 trainees in a 3-position program. And if you can imagine having 12 resident trainees in a Central Oregon, the capacity to increase regional access to mental health would be tremendous, both through those patients coming to the trainees, as well as the trainees traveling and using telemedicine to increase access. The advantage of having this affiliated with OHSU is that you would share in opportunities both for the rural trainees to come back to OHSU at times to achieve training requirements that are not achievable in the rural setting, and then trainees who we have at OHSU could go to the rural environment to experience a rural setting as well. So there's a real efficiency in having program reside within OHSU, but have that as a satellite training center. The cost is really overcome through a combination of resources from clinical and contract incomes. Local folks are very invested in this, as you've heard from others, and then the funding from this bill. I just wanted to mention a few other ways that this funding might be used for the mental health system. There are opportunities to potentially create a mental health physician assistant program that could potentially be the way that psychologists learn how to prescribe medicines in a primary care medical setting. We could increase fellowship training for mental PAs to further subspecialize in mental health care. Of course, expanding residencies and other training approaches for master's and doctoral level therapists in the rural setting would be of incredible importance. We really do not have adequate, high-quality therapeutic service, psychotherapy services in rural settings. Early childhood experts, preventing and promoting health is something that really requires high levels of expertise, and identifying and treating autism is an extraordinary need in our state. And then finally, there's a great emphasis in peer support as a new strategy to improve healthcare outcomes, and we don't really have a Center for Excellence or centralized capacity to train peer support specialists and how to work in a medical environment. Just finally to mention that the other way to improve things is to improve primary care capacity to deliver care themselves. And we could expand programs like Opal K, which is a consult line, by adding telemedicine to that line. We could develop an Opal A, which would be a psychiatric access program for adults. And then ECHO, which is a extension for community health outcomes, is a strategy to train primary care providers in a range of health conditions and has proven very effective so far in our child psychiatry program. I've attached reports regarding Opal K and ECHO to my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you all. I appreciate your brevity, and I'm sorry I have to push you so hard to be brief.
No,
we really appreciate you coming here and helping us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Okay. We're going to call. We have, what, two more on the one bill?
I have two more on 3345.
Let's get those.
Tim Churchill and Matt Minahan.
Again, please be as brief as you can. We're out of time, and we have four more witnesses to call after these.
I'll be very brief.
Appreciate that.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent EC Blend and select clients of the vaping and retail industry. Apologize that the Dash 1 isn't before you today. I thought it would be, so I'll briefly explain that in a moment. But I'd like to say we have never been against the Clean Air Act. The only issue we've ever had with it is not in allowing us, including our vape shops in that, and not in allowing us to vape in a vape shop. I want to point out that it's the goal of my retailers to get people to stop smoking and transition over to what they believe is a healthier product than vaping. That is a process. It takes determining what nicotine level somebody has, what flavor. If a pack-a-day smoker comes into a shop, they're going to have a different nicotine level and maybe a different flavor than somebody who maybe smokes three cigarettes a day. And again, that is a process. To get them through that, they need to sample the product and, you know, what feels like a cigarette, what's going to help me stop smoking. The Dash 1 is a remedy to that, and I know you don't have it before you, so I'll just go through the details.
Very briefly, please.
Yeah, the Dash 1 basically says no minors in the store, no nicotine level. So although that's an important piece, that was kind of a consensus on our part, not necessarily from the opposition, but from some legislators. No minors in the store, no nicotine in the sampling, no malls, so it will not include any locations in the malls, and limited 10 seats. So it was very, we gave as much as we could on that, all we're asking for, and we're not allowing to vape in the vape shops completely. This is just for the purpose of sampling. So a customer comes in, they've been smoking a pack a day, they can take a couple puffs, puff one, puff two, I'll take the strawberry as opposed to the root beer, and they get out of the stores. It's not to sit around and vape in the vape shops. It is simply for sampling purposes, and like I say, we've given everything we could on that. We've minimized that as much as possible, and very important part of the process. So we would urge, once you get a consideration on the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Okay. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. Thank you for the time to speak with you today. My name is Tim Churchill. I drove up from Medford this morning. I work with EC Blend, who is an e-liquid manufacturer in Medford, and we support the Dash 1 amendment on this bill. The tasting of these flavors in the combination and the combination of the base mixes is very important for those customers that want to make the transition from away from smoking. I know as an ex-smoker of 30 years, it was vital to me to be able to adjust what I needed to wean myself from nicotine, and now I no longer vape either. So I'm living proof. These customers need to be able to try this product and to experience this from themselves to what to purchase. The vape shops are at a disadvantage to some of the cigar and smoke shops who can allow some of their customers to be able to sample their products. So we would urge you to please pass this with the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you both. We'll consider that. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3345. And would you call the last four witnesses, please? On House Bill 3085.
Kendall Mason, Elise Brown, Dan Cushing, and Pat Kennymore.
If you can drag a chair over for the fourth. While we're doing that, I'll just remind people we're carrying over a work session on 2114. And on 2388, both to Wednesday, and we'll try and have the work ready for them. You're all standing between us and adjournment, so go for it.
No pressure. Good afternoon, Chair, Vice Chair Hayden. For the record, my name is Dan Cushing. You are all very patient listeners today, and I've cut my testimony drastically. I just wanted to say that I was glad that Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned social workers several times today in her testimony, and I wanted to put into the record that social workers are trained in, I'm here representing the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon chapter. And I just want to say that social workers are trained in mental and behavioral health care, including individual counseling, family and relationship counseling, and drug and alcohol addiction treatment. And by some accounts, 60% of mental health professionals in the United States are clinically trained social workers. A lot of people don't know that. Social workers provide mental health services in a variety of settings, including community mental health programs, disaster relief programs, employee assistance, military and veteran, etc. And given the importance of mental health care, particularly in our underserved populations in our rural communities, we believe that social workers can be important partners in helping communities meet their health care needs. And on behalf of NASW, I want to express our support for HB 3085. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, my name is Kendall Mason, and I am a political and policy strategist for SEIU Local 503, and I'm here today also representing SEIU Local 49 in support of House Bill 3085, with the caveat that we ask, much like my friend next to me was asking, that we broaden the definition of what healthcare workers are, at least go through the trouble of defining it. I'll point just mostly to my testimony, but I just want to leave you with that. SEIU Local 503 represents over 25,000 home care, personal support, assisted living, nursing home workers, and SEIU Local 49 represents over 7,000 workers with 50 different classes within the healthcare spectrum. And we are all aware of the exploding population and the aging population in Oregon and the crisis in the workforce that we're already facing, and so we just like to take this opportunity to make sure we're including long-term care workers when we're talking about health care.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown, for the record, representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and as you all know, AHIP is the National Trade Association of Health Plans across the country, and I apologize, Betsy Earls was hoping to join me with AOI OBA to share her concerns on House Bill 3085. So Senator Steiner Hayward said it right, and we agree wholeheartedly that Oregon suffers a shortage of new health care providers, particularly in rural Oregon. We care very much about that. And in Oregon, we're terrific at creating Oregon solutions to fix Oregon's problems. And we really think the idea of a healthcare professional training fund is an intriguing idea. But before we're quick to suggest that Oregon insurers foot the bill, my ask of you is to make sure we look at the numbers and what the impacts might be. The question was from Representative Kenny Geyer, what do the numbers look like? Well, we know that 3085 assesses a 1 cent per day per member to fully insured, self-insured TPAs, but not CCOs. So here's one carrier's example. 1 cent per day per member at 700,000 members is $7,000 a day, which equates to $2.5 million a year. So that's roughly $5 million from one carrier. And we would estimate from AHIP Oregon members that it would probably be close to $10 million for all carriers in Oregon. So that's a big number. Is this assessment or is this assumption that carriers would absorb this without passing it through? And would the assessment be visible to the Oregonians who are going to pay for it? So those are questions that we have. I would say for the record that Senator Steiner Hayward has provided consistently provided great leadership in bringing stakeholders together to address Oregon's health care problems. And AHIP Oregon members are hopeful we can work within a larger stakeholder framework to sit down together, collaborate, and agree on how to tackle this issue in a way that's equitable for everyone. Those are my comments, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Bringing up the rear, my name is Pat Kennymore, and I want to say thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak today. I'm a physician assistant, longtime member of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. I've been in clinical practice for 25 years. My primary role, however, right now is as the associate director and academic coordinator of the PA program at OHSU. I'm responsible for all the didactic education for our PA students. OHSU has a national reputation, and we attract applicants from all over the United States. Our mission, however, is to prepare PAs for the practice of medicine to diverse populations, including the medically underserved, and to contribute to meeting the workforce needs of Oregon. And I'm happy to report that we actually have pretty good success in getting our folks to stay in Oregon. Currently, 55% of our OHSU graduates practice in Oregon from 2015 data. We have people who come to us because of our mission. They wish to stay in Oregon. They want to work in underserved communities, and they often can't because opportunities don't exist for them. Still in all, our numbers are better than national data. We have 23% of our PAs work in rural areas compared to a fairly poor national average of only 12.7%. We do have a good track record for our graduates choosing primary care. Nationally, only about 28% of PAs end up in primary care because that's where the job opportunities are. Recall that our licenses are tied to those of physicians. So as physicians move into specialty areas, so do PAs due to the way our work is structured. However, 41% of our PA graduates from OHSU do end up going into primary care. Part of the reason that we are successful in doing this are directly related to some of the incentives that have recently been made available. We have SHOE scholars. We have our rural health scholars. And so any of the incentives that can be made to help offset some of the challenges with practice in smaller communities is incredibly important. So we're in favor of both of these bills and are appreciative of both Senator Steiner Hayward as well as Representative Nathanson for bringing these proposals forward, because they'll certainly help those graduates of ours who truly wish to go back into the state of Oregon to provide for patients in rural and underserved areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3085. Thank the committee for patience. We're almost 15 minutes late, but not quite. We're adjourned. We're adjourned.